Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're setting off on a journey through time, really exploring the rich history of Kurdish tribes and the principalities they established right across the Middle East.
Yes, and we've got quite a collection here. Historical surveys, dynastic accounts, geopolitical analyses. It's fascinating stuff. Mm-hmm. Our aim is really to pull out the most compelling insights. You know, how these tribes and emirates actually rose, how they interacted with the bigger empires around them, and the mark they ultimately left.
And for you, the listener, we want to illuminate those key periods, the really influential figures, and that complex interplay of power that shaped Kurdish history. We're aiming for those aha moments without getting bogged down in, well, overwhelming detail.
Exactly. So let's start right at the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
What do the terms Kurd and Kurdistan actually mean in a historical context?
Okay. The sources suggest the Kurds are an Iranian ethnic group, yeah. And their roots might go way back, potentially to Indo-European tribes in the Zagros Mountains, maybe around the second millennium BC.
Mm-hmm. And we even get these early hints, don't we? Like the ancient Greek references to the Kardachoi. They're the ones who resisted Xenophon's 10,000 back in 401 BC. Quite a famous encounter.
Right. And then later, after the 7th century Arab conquests, the term Akrad starts getting used, initially, it seems, for various nomadic groups in the Zagros.
But over time, it evolved, didn't it? It became a more distinct ethnic identifier for the Kurds.
And the word Kurdistan itself, meaning land of the Kurds, that first pops up in Seljuk Chronicles around the 11th century.
And then around 1150 AD, something quite significant happens. The Seljuk Sultan Sanjar actually creates a formal province named Kurdistan.
He did. Where was that exactly?
Its capital was Bahar, which is near modern Hamadan, and it covered quite a region. Sinjar, Shahrazur, Hamadan itself, Dinawar, Kermanshah, places we still recognize.
So historically, Kurdistan wasn't a fixed border on a map like today, but more of this broad region, northwestern Zagros, eastern Taurus Mountains.
Precisely. A region now split between Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. And that Seljuk province, it's interesting because while it acknowledged the sort of ethnogeographic reality on the ground, It also shows that interaction between local identities and these big imperial powers trying to, you know, administer them, they were recognizing it, incorporating it.
Okay, that makes sense. So moving on, what about the nature of Kurdish society itself, the tribal structures and how they formed political units?
Well, historically, Kurdish society was very strongly tribal. That's fundamental. And it deeply influenced how political organization worked.
So power wasn't just centralized?
Not always, no. It was often expressed through these tribal confederations, or sometimes more formal emirates. You can think of them as principalities, maybe, ruled by really powerful tribal dynasties.
And these emirates, they weren't just isolated?
No, they often exerted control over weaker neighboring tribes and also the settled non-tribal population. Sometimes they formed these quite large super tribal units.
What about their military? How did that work?
A key feature was their military self-reliance. Their armies were mostly made up of Kurdish tribesmen, especially known for their cavalry.
Right.
Which is quite different from some other powers at the time who relied heavily on, say, slave soldiers, Mamluks, and the like.
But that reliance on tribesmen must have had its own challenges.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sources point this out clearly. An emir's power often really hinged on keeping the loyalty of all those individual tribal chieftains.
So potential for instability.
Definitely. It could lead to internal rivalries, a more fragmented political landscape. Hmm. Maintaining that loyalty was a constant balancing act, using alliances, resources, respecting customs, personal charisma, military success. Oh. It was all part of the mix.
Okay. Now, there's one source that seems absolutely central to understanding this period. The Sharafnama.
Oh, completely. It's foundational. Written in Persian back in 1597 by Sharaf al-Din Bitlisi. He was himself a Kurdish prince and scholar from the Emirate of Bitlis.
And it's basically the most important early comprehensive history of the Kurdish people.
Without a doubt. It meticulously details so many Kurdish dynasties. The Ayyubids are in there, of course. And lots of principalities like Ardalan, Badenin, Baban, Sorin, Hakkari, Bitlis itself.
Why Persian, though? Why not write it in Kurdish?
That's a great question. Writing in Persian gave him access to a much wider audience,
yeah.
You know, within that whole Perso-Islamic cultural world. It definitely enhanced the perceived legitimacy, the standing of Kurdish history.
And didn't he send copies out to other Kurdish leaders?
He reportedly did, yes. which could suggest, perhaps, it wasn't just about recording history. Maybe it was also a subtle way to assert the authority and prestige of his own bitless rulers.
And Persian as the language of sort of high discourse.
Exactly. It positioned Kurdish history within a recognized intellectual tradition, while potentially serving those political aims too. It's a fascinating document from multiple angles.
Now, we can't really understand these emirates without looking at the bigger picture, the geopolitical context.
Absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. These Kurdish tribes and emirates, they were very often located right on the frontiers, the borderlands, between major rival empires.
So from the 16th century on, that means primarily the Ottomans to the west.
And various Persian empires to the east. The Safavids initially, then the Afsharids, Zands, Qajars later on. Those were the big players.
And the Kurdish emirates were caught in the middle?
Pretty much. They often existed as these semi-independent entities, their autonomy waxing and waning depending on the conflicts and diplomacy between Istanbul and Isfahan or Tehran.
And that Treaty of Zuhab in 1639, that was a major moment, wasn't it?
A huge moment. It formally partitioned Kurdish lands between the Ottomans and the Safavids. The consequences of that division are still felt today, really.
So the overarching theme here is this constant negotiation for survival, for autonomy.
Precisely. Perpetual maneuvering, trying to carve out space and survive amidst these massive imperial ambitions, it required incredible political skill.
Okay, let's get into some specific examples now, starting with those earlier Kurdish dynasties, maybe 10th to 12th centuries, sometimes called a Kurdish interlude.
Right. During this period, several Kurdish dynasties did rise to prominence. It shows an early capacity for state building. And again, their military strength came from those Kurdish tribal warriors.
And they were quite spread out geographically.
They were. From Anatolia down into Persia, across to Azerbaijan, it shows a significant Kurdish political presence on these really vital frontiers.
But maybe being so spread out was also a weakness.
That's a very sharp point. While it showed influence, it might have made them more vulnerable when larger, more unifying forces like the Seljuk Turks came along. Harder to present a united front, perhaps.
A good example might be the Marwanids. They ruled from 983 to 1085.
Yes, the Marwanids are fascinating. They were based in Diyarbakir, or Umid, as it was known, and controlled parts of Armenia, too. The founder, Bad ibn Dustak, the story goes he was a shepherd who rose through military strength.
And their state wasn't just a tribal chiefdom.
No, it evolved into what historians call a cosmopolitan frontier state. Lots of interaction between different ethnic and religious groups.
And they had a golden age, didn't they? Under Nasr al-Dawla Ahmad and Marwan.
They did. His reign was a real high point. Known for cultural patronage, lots of building fortifications, bridges. That amazing Dikko Bridge, the Tenide Bridge, dates from 1065.
Whoa.
He established libraries, attracted scholars, poets. It was a time of relative peace, flourishing trade, artistic achievements. They even took Edessa modern Şanlıurfa in 1026.
So this really challenges any simplistic view of these early Kurdish groups as just, you know, rough warriors.
Absolutely. It shows sophisticated statecraft, patronage of learning, real cultural depth.
But like you said, they eventually fell to the Seljuks.
Yes, in 1085.
Yeah.
A reminder of how power shifted in the region.
And there were others around this time too, the Shadids.
Right, the Shadids. Ruled in parts of Armenia and Iran, 951 to 1199. Considered one of the four major Kurdish principalities of the 10th century. Shows that long Kurdish presence up in the Caucasus.
Then the Hasanawides.
Hasanawides, yes. In the eastern Jebal region, western Iran, Kermanshah, Dinawar area, 959 to 1015. Another of those four major ones. Strong position in the central Zagros.
And the Anisids.
Anisids or Banu Anis. Contemporary with the Hasanawides. Also in eastern Jebal, 990 to 1117. They managed to hold on to autonomy for over a century.
For the Rawadids, based near Tabriz.
Well, Rawadids, yeah. Around Tabriz and Marage in Azerbaijan from the 900s, maybe to 1071 or 1115. Interestingly, they were of Arab origin but became Kurdicized.
And they're important because?
Because the later Ayyubid dynasty, Saladin's family, trace their lineage back to a branch of the Rawadids, the Hadabani tribal branch.
Ah, okay. And the Hadabani themselves were also a power.
Yes. A prominent Kurdish tribe ruling around Erbil and parts of eastern Azerbaijan, 900s to 1144, also linked ancestrally to the Ayyubids. So you see these connections forming early on.
So taken together, the rise of these principalities really shows the capacity of Kurdish tribes to build lasting political structures.
Definitely. Hmm. And their eventual absorption by the Seljuks, well, it set a kind of precedent, didn't it? for how Kurdish polities would interact with these larger Turkic-led empires later on.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Posh Hannah. This smells wonderful today. Definitely a hint of cardamom, I think. Oh, lovely. It looks like she's added just the right amount of sugar. It's not too bitter at all. Perfect. Ah, perfect timing. It does smell lovely. A very welcome treat indeed. Thank you, Hannah.
Okay, welcome back. Now, feeling refreshed with that lovely chai, let's shift our focus to what many see as a real high point of Kurdish power. The Ayyubid dynasty. That's 12th and 13th centuries.
Yes. The rise of the Ayyubids was definitely a major turning point. Here you have a family demonstrably of Kurdish origin controlling this vast empire, Egypt, Syria, Yemen, Mesopotamia.
Huge area.
Massive. And their role in the Crusades, their influence in the wider Islamic world, it really marks a peak of Kurdish power on the international stage of the time.
And Saladin is obviously the figure everyone knows, but the Kurdish origins of the dynasty itself are key, right?
Mm.
Absolutely. The founder, Salah ad-Din Yusuf ibn Ayyub Saladin, he belonged to the Rawadiya clan. That was a Kurdish branch of the Hadabani tribe we just mentioned.
Ah, the connection again.
Exactly. His family came from Duvin in medieval Armenia.
Yeah.
And crucially, contemporary Muslim historians, people like Ibn Khalik and Ibn Athir, they explicitly noted Saladin's Kurdish ethnicity. It wasn't hidden.
And the state itself was sometimes called the Kurdish dynasty.
It was al-Dawla al-Qurad. Which really highlights their background. It marks this incredible period where Kurds weren't just local leaders anymore, but rulers of a major empire. A huge shift in scale.
So under Saladin and his successors, did they establish specifically Kurdish regions within the empire?
Well, yes and no. Kurdish chieftainships were certainly established within the Ayyubid domain. But it's important to grasp that the Ayyubid state was more like a confederation of principalities, governed by Saladin's extended family.
Okay.
It wasn't a unified block of autonomous Kurdish tribal regions. Loyalty was ultimately to the Ayyubid Sultan, to the family.
The Kurds were important in the military.
Hugely important. They formed a substantial part of the Ayyubid army, especially that famous cavalry. You had prominent tribal corps like Al-Hakkariya, Al-Marania, Al-Humaydiya, Al-Zarzariya.
And later, didn't another tribe become dominant?
Yes. Under Sultan al-Salih Ayyub, the Al-Qaymariya tribe rose to prominence within the military elite.
And how were these military commanders supported?
Through the ecosystem, mainly, granting land revenues to military commanders for their service. And Kurdish fiefholders certainly benefited significantly from this.
So Ayyubid success definitely elevated Kurds, but it didn't create a unified Kurdish state as such.
Exactly. And over time, especially in places like Egypt and Syria, the later Ayyubid rulers became increasingly Arabized in culture and language.
Right. So the centralized sultanate, especially based in Egypt, meant this Kurdish-led power didn't really translate into, say, pan-Kurdish nationalism.
Not in the modern sense, no. Kurdish identity was clearly one component, an important one, but within this larger multicultural empire. It shows how complex identity and politics were back then. Ethnic origin could bring you to power without necessarily creating a nation-state idea.
And there was a cultural impact, too, Kurdish migration.
Yes, quite notable. We see the appearance of distinct Kurdish quarters, Harut al-Akrad, popping up in major cities. Aleppo, Baghdad, Cairo, Damascus, even Gaza, Hebron, Jerusalem.
Wow. And they founded institutions.
They did. Kurdish notables founded religious and charitable institutions, like the Rabat al-Kurd in Jerusalem, founded in 1294. This dispersal spread Kurdish populations and cultural influence well beyond their traditional mountain heartlands, creating communities in these diverse cities.
But didn't the Ayyubid military also start using Turkic Mamluks?
Yes, and that's a crucial turn. They brought in Turkic Mamluks, who eventually became so powerful they supplanted the Ayyubids themselves in Egypt in 1250.
So a cautionary tale about relying on distinct military elites within your own empire.
Very much so. It underscores how fluid power could be. The group that rises can eventually be overtaken by another powerful faction.
Okay, let's move forward again into what you call the Age of Empires, maybe 14th, 16th century up to the 19th. This is where we see lots of these semi-independent Kurdish emirates really coming into focus.
Exactly. These emirates, still deeply rooted in those tribal structures, had to navigate life between the Ottomans and the Persians. Their autonomy, as we said, really fluctuated depending on imperial power dynamics and their own internal cohesion.
And the Sharifnama is key again for this period.
Absolutely invaluable for understanding these emirates. And a persistent feature, unfortunately, was rivalry among the emirates themselves.
Which weakened them collectively.
Often, yes. It certainly challenged any broader, unified Kurdish political action. Let's look at some major examples. Ardalan, for instance.
Right, the Emirate of Ardalan. Western Iran, modern Kurdistan province, capital at Sanandaj. Lasted a long time, didn't it? Maybe 14th century to the 1860s.
Roughly, yes. The ruling Bani Ardalan tribe even claimed descent from the Marwanids, trying to establish that historical legitimacy. They kept a degree of independence until about 1617, then became more of a semi-independent Persian frontier province.
So generally loyal to the Persian Shahs?
Generally, yes, until they were dissolved around 1865, 1868. Being on that border, though, they were masters of shifting allegiances to preserve autonomy. Rulers like Halo Khan, Khan Ahmad Khan, they were part of the Persian elite, held titles.
And their main Kurdish rival was Baban.
Yes, we'll get to them. Culturally, Ardalan was incredibly important for patronizing Gorani Kurdish literature.
Gorani.
Yes, it became a really sophisticated literary language, a Quenay, in the 17th, 18th centuries. Ardalan princes were often poets themselves. Its fall sadly led to a decline in Gorani literature. Halo Khan is also remembered for building projects, like rebuilding Maravan Castle.
Okay, so then the Emirate of Baban. Present-day Iraqi Kurdistan, capital later moved to Sulaymaniyah, founded 1784.
Right, though Kala Sulan was an earlier center, their origins are a bit murky. Shirafkin mentions a Pir Budik Beg in the early 16th century. Others say maybe mid-17th century. They lasted until 1850 when the Ottomans finally annexed the Shirazer region.
And they were caught in the Ottoman-Safavid thing, too.
Very much so. Generally sided with the Ottomans, but pragmatically, you know. Their territory shifted a lot due to rivalries with Ardalan, Botan, Soran, and imperial interference and succession disputes didn't help stability.
Any famous Baban rulers?
Fakih Ahmad Darshmana, Ibrahim Pasha Baban, Abdurrahman Pasha, Ahmed Pasha is the last one, defeated in 1850. Culturally, Baban is absolutely crucial for developing Sorani Kurdish as a literary and administrative language.
So Ardalan for Gorani, Baban for Sorani?
Largely, yes, though Gorani was also used in Baban. But Sulaymaniyah really became the Sorani cultural hub.
No, Soran. That had a dramatic revival, didn't it? Under Mir Muhammad, the blind emir?
It certainly did. Medieval origins, maybe 14th century, but then this incredible revival under Mir Muhammad of Rwandu's core emir, from 1816 to 1836.
What did he do?
He really consolidated power, built a strong citadel in Rwandu's, created a modern army, reports say 30,000, maybe even 50,000 tribal musketeers, paid salaries.
Wow, that's serious.
And he went on the offensive, conquered parts of Baban, extended his influence massively from Erbil and Kirkuk, way over towards Mardin, Sisra, Nusaybin, even gained authority over Badinan and parts of Bataan.
He acted like an independent ruler.
Very much so. Struck his own coins, had his name in the Friday prayers, classic signs of sovereignty.
Which must have worried the Ottomans.
Definitely alarmed them. They sent an army in 1834. He actually repelled them initially, but was later pressured to go to Istanbul. Supposedly confirmed his mir, but then he just disappeared all the way back.
Really? Disappeared?
Vanished. His brother ruled briefly, but the emirate soon fell to Ottoman centralization. Mirkor is remembered, though, a major revolt, that sense of Kurdish awareness, uniting areas, distinct uniforms. A powerful figure.
Okay, next up, Botan, or Botan, centered on Sisra, 14th century to 1855.
That's the one. The ruling Azizan dynasty traced its lineage back, maybe to the Umayyads even. Shirafkan notes Mir Ezzedin Abdal swore allegiance to Timur way back in 1394.
And the Ottomans gave them special status.
After 1514, yes. A hukumet status, recognizing hereditary rule, right up until 1855.
And their most famous ruler was Bedir Khan Beg.
Bedir Khan Beg, yes. Mm-hmm. Ruled 1821 to 1847. A really powerful emir. Modernized his military, provided security so people actually moved into Botan, expanded influence from Diyarbakir to Mosul, Urmia.
Minted coins, too, like Mirkor.
Yes. Minted coins, reformed taxes, organized justice. Sisra really flourished under him. He made alliances with Mukus and Hakkari.
But his relationship with the Ottomans soured.
It did.
Yeah.
Initially supported them, like at the Battle of Nizip in 1839, but his growing power caused friction. And his reign is sadly marked by those massacres, Yazidis in 1832, with Soran and Nestorian Assyrians in Hakkari in 43 and 46.
Why did those happen?
Partly encouraged by Ottoman fears about Western missionary influence among the Assyrians. It tragically ended Assyrian autonomy in Hakkari.
And Bedir Khan himself was eventually defeated.
Yes, by a large Ottoman army, which included vengeful Yazidis in 1847. He was exiled. And the Ottomans created that new province of Kurdistan then, tightening control.
But Botan was important culturally for Kurmanji.
Hugely important for Kurmanji Kurdish literature. Classical poets like Malay Sisiri, 1570 to 1640, and Fikiye Tehran, 1590-1660, were from Botan. And Emedi Azani's masterpiece, Memu Zin, though Zani was from Hakkari, it drew heavily on Botan's oral traditions and was widely read in Botan's madrasas.
Okay, Hakkari next. Around Hakkari City, west of Lake Urmia, pre-1380s to 1847.
Right. They governed a really mixed population, Kurdish tribes, Nestorian Assyrians as vassals, Armenian farmers, though they didn't control some fiercely independent Assyrian tribes like the Tiari.
Founded by Izz al-Din Shir.
Around the 1380s, yes. His dynasty became the Shambo. Though some Armenian sources suggest a different lineage, maybe Artsruni, it's contested.
And like the others, caught between empires.
Absolutely. Strategic location meant shifting allegiances. Timurids, Karakoyunlu, Ottomans, Safavids. Lots of internal strife, too, fragmented into smaller bits in the 16th, 18th centuries.
And in the 19th century, they allied with Bedir Khan.
Emir Nurullah Beg did.
Yes.
And got involved in those 1843 Assyrian massacres, again, partly due to Ottoman concerns about missionaries.
And the Ottomans used that instability.
They did. Used it to assert control. Defeated the coalition in 1847, absorbed Hakkari. Life there was mostly pastoralism, agriculture. Tribal agas were important locally. Ottomans often recognized the hereditary emirs as Sankak Biz, district governors.
Finally, Bitlis. Emirate of Bitlis and the Rojiki tribe, 1182 to 1847.
Yes. Centered on Bitlis City. Founded by the Rojiki Tribal Confederation, maybe even 10th century roots, formalized by 1182. They took Bitlis and Sassoon from the Georgians. 18 Rojiki princes by the time Sharaf Khan was writing.
And Sharaf Khan himself was from Bitlis.
He was. Emir of Bitlis from 1578 to 1597. Another key ruler was Abdal Khan, mid-17th century. Evliya Çelebi called him a Renaissance prince, praises library. Tavernier called him the most powerful independent Kurd, barely acknowledging Ottoman or Safavid rule.
And he led a revolt.
The Rojiki revolt against the Ottomans in 1655. Before that, they'd navigated the Ottoman-Safavid rivalry, mostly siding with the Ottomans, but briefly switching to the Safavids in 1531, which led to an Ottoman capture. They were good at playing the game to stay independent.
Strong military, too.
Formidable. Thousands of cavalry. But after Abdal Khan's revolt in 1655, their autonomy was reduced, integrated more into the Van province. Still, early 17th century, Bitlis was arguably the top Kurdish emirate cultural, religious, economic center. Evliya Çelebi mentions lots of Yazidis in Abdal Khan's 1655 army, too.
And culturally influenced by Persian.
Significantly, yes. Mm. Persian language and traditions were strong in administration, literature, diplomacy.
So looking back at all these emirates, that semi-independence was really fragile, wasn't it? It depended so much on what the big empires were doing.
Very fragile, very fluid. It expanded when the empires fought each other, contracted when they were strong and centralizing. Kurdish autonomy was often more a side effect of imperial strategy than a recognized right.
And that cultural patronage, Gorani and Ardalan, Sarani and Baban, Kurmanji and Botan Bitlis, that was key for their identity, even while they participated in Ottoman or Persian culture, like a biculturalism.
Exactly. It was vital for asserting their unique identity. And yes, that inter-emirate rivalry was a constant weakness, often exploited by the empires.
But figures like Mir Kor and Bedir Khan, trying to consolidate power, they became symbols, didn't they?
Huge symbols of Kurdish autonomy and resistance. Even though their attempts ultimately led to confrontation and defeat, their memory is powerful.
No, it wasn't just emirates. What about large tribal confederations like the Jaff?
The Jaff are another major piece of the puzzle. They trace dynastic origins way back to 1114, Zahir Big Jaff. But the big confederation probably formed early 17th century. They aren't in the 1597 Sharafnama.
And they were primarily nomadic.
Yes, until the 20th century. Their heartland straddled the Iraq-Iran border around Sulaymaniyya and Esenandaj. Big settlements in Halabja, Kalar, Sulaymaniyya, Rovansar, Sanandaj, Suwanro, Kermanshah, Kanakin. This transborder thing was key.
Subject to multiple states, one of the largest Kurdish confederations.
Definitely one of the biggest. Iraqi Jaff, sometimes called Maradi, Iranian ones Yavin Rudi. Shawana Castle was their ancestral seat, hereditary leadership, and the Ottomans gave them the title of Pasha from the 1700s.
Any famous Jaff leaders besides the founder?
Muhammad Pasha Jaff built Shawana Castle 1734. Osman Pasha Jaff married Lady Adela Khanum Jaff, the Princess of the Brave. She was incredibly influential during Sheikh Mahmud Barzanji's uprisings. Mahmud Pasha Jaff and the contemporary leader Nazdad Dawoodbeg Jaff. Early 20th century, they had serious power in Iraq. Huge military strength, maybe 100,000 rifles in 1933.
How did they interact with the empires and other Kurds?
complex. Ottomans gave them the Pasha title to buy loyalty in that strategic zone. They fought Ardalan in the late 17th century, lost, fled to Baban territory for a bit. Baban gave them refuge and grazing land. Post-WWI, they actually opposed Sheikh Mahmud Barzanji and resisted British policies in Iraq.
And culturally, what language?
Mostly Shafi Sunni Muslims, with Naqshbandi and Qadiriyya Sufi followers. Majority Sirani speakers were about the Babani dialect because of those Baban ties. But interestingly, 17th, 19th century Jaff princes also patronized Guarani literature.
Really? Barani too?
Yes, and they produced major poets. Kanai Kobadi Jaff, Guarani Nali Jaff, foundational Sirani poet, Abdullah Guran Jaff, modernizing Sirani poet, and contemporary figures like Tar Jaff, the harpist. Yeah. That division into Marathi, Iraq, and Javanrudi, Iran, really shows how those borders cut through tribal groups.
And there are countless other tribes too, right?
Oh, absolutely. The Mahmudi tribe near Lake Van Evelia Chelebi claimed they could field 60,000 warriors. Their chief, Sari Suleiman Bey, strengthened Hushab Castle in 1643. And tribes spread all across Persia, Azerbaijan, Kurdistan, Hamadan, Luristan, Kustan, Jilan, Mazandaran.
Showing interaction with Azeris.
Right. Kurdicized Azeris, Turkicized Kurds, Lakhi's speakers. And Persian shahs often deliberately moved Kurdish tribes around for strategic reasons, causing massive disruption. Plus migrations into central Anatolia, Modanla, Şanbeyli, Reşvan, Şikspiyan. It's a vast, complex tapestry.
So looking across all this history, what are the common threads that you see?
Well, first, that constant pursuit of autonomy, of self-rule. Even as vassals, that desire was there. Ottoman strategy sometimes allowed it, but it was conditional, and the 19th century centralization efforts crushed most of it. But the aspiration? That remains potent.
Second, the internal dynamics, alliances and rivalries.
Yes. Those internal divisions, Ardalan versus Baban, for example, they were common, weakened the collective position, and were exploited by empires. But you also had cooperation, like Bedr's Khan's alliance. It wasn't monolithic.
Third, navigating the big empires.
Constant maneuvering between Ottomans and Persians. Shifting allegiances. Idris Bidlisi helping the Ottoman-Sunni-Kurd alliance against the Safavids, but also countless rebellions against centralization. Imperial policy swung wildly co-optation, like the Hamidi cavalry, but also brutal suppression and forced resettlements.
And what caused these emirates to rise and fall?
Rise often came from strong leadership, tribal unity, strategic location, or when the empires were weak. Fall came from imperial centralization. The Ottoman-Tanzimat reforms were key direct military intervention, those internal rivalries, and just the changing geopolitical map. Empires actively worked against a single, powerful Kurdish entity emerging. The 19th century really was the end for most autonomous Kurdish rule.
But despite all that political fragmentation, there's this vibrant cultural legacy.
Absolutely enduring. The patronage of Kurdish language and literature is huge. Guarani under Ardalan and Jaff princes. Sirani under Baban, with Süleymaniye as its heart. Kumanji flourishing in Botan, linked to Memuzin. These Kurdish courts supported poets, scholars, kept the language alive and evolving.
Although the different dialects maybe complicated things later for unity.
That's true. The flourishing of dialects was culturally rich, but created challenges for a single literary standard later on. Also crucial was the development of madrasas, those centers of learning.
Where were they prominent?
Cities like Kre, Zakol, were renowned. Aklat was known for natural sciences, even had an observatory. Bitlis under Abdal Khan, with his library. These madrasas preserved and transmitted Kurdish literature and thought.
And how does all this history impact Kurdish identity today?
Profoundly. The historical memory of these emirates, the Ayyubids, Mir Kor, Bedr Khan, feeds directly into modern Kurdish national consciousness, into aspirations for self-determination. The Sharafnama itself is proof of a long historical consciousness.
Right.
That memory of having local rule, prosperity under their own leaders, fostered a distinction from outside officials. Having had autonomous states provides a powerful historical precedent for self-rule, a core element in modern Kurdish identity.
It really is an incredible story, isn't it? The Kurdish tribes, their emirates. It's a testament to this enduring spirit, this incredibly complex history. From fighting ancient Greeks to navigating vast empires, creating unique cultures, their legacy still shapes the region today.
It truly does. And we really hope this exploration today has given you, our listeners, some valuable insights, maybe sparked some new questions or curiosity. That pursuit of autonomy, that delicate balance between internal life and external pressures, the vibrant culture, these threads run right through centuries of Kurdish history.
So what stands out most to you from hearing about this archive? What questions are still lingering, making you want to look further? We really encourage you to keep exploring this fascinating history. The sources we've touched on offer such a rich starting point for a deeper understanding of this absolutely pivotal part of Middle Eastern history.